comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, the nonprofit agency providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston, Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Henry Frain is at the controls. Tomorrow morning on the program in the first hour, we'll be talking about status anxiety, something that probably in human society is not really new, although it seems to be more and more pressing as time goes along. And basically what we're talking about there is the keeping up with the Joneses syndrome. When you look at your friends and neighbors and your people that you know, and they have stuff that you don't, how do you deal with that? Alan de Botton will be our guest for the program. He's the author of the book, How Proust Can Change Your Life, and has authored a new book titled Status Anxiety. That's hour one. Hour two, we'll talk about American politics with Donna Brazile. She's a senior political strategist. She was the former campaign manager for Gore Lieberman 2000 and as adjunct professor at Georgetown. And she has a new book out, which is entitled Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics. She'll talk with us tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we welcome your questions and your comments. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about prescription drugs and inviting your questions on that subject. And our guest is James Rybacki. He is a pharmacist. He is a member of the clinical faculty at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy and also does a lot of writing and speaking on the subject of prescription medicines. He has put together a book that has been coming out now every year for a number of years that's a reference guide to prescription drugs. And the current one is entitled The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2004. It's published by HarperCollins. It is available as a paperback, and it's a good resource for anyone who uses prescription medicines because it lists them, talks about what they're for, looks at potential side effects, kinds of interactions, and so forth. So it would be a good resource for you and your family, and might be a good thing to have on your bookshelf at home. Let me tell you a little bit more about Dr. Rybacki. He is board certified in pain management at the diplomat level by the American Academy of Pain Management. He's also a member of the National Council of Hospice Professionals. He's president of the Clearwater Group that provides drug information support and clinical pharmacy services to groups of physicians and consumers and employers. It also holds seminars on a number of subjects, including medical cost containment, infectious disease, pain management, and he has been interviewed many times, often on radio and television, talking about these subjects. He's joining us this morning by phone, and as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Rybacki, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm glad. Good, thanks. And I'm very glad you could be with us again. We certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Oh, absolutely. It's always a wonderful group of questions, and my God, I'm having medication anxiety just keeping up with all the changing data, as always.
Well, I'm sure that that is the case. One of the questions I just thought I would ask right off, and I expect you probably could answer this question, is
okay. What
percentage or how many Americans currently take one or more prescription medicines?
You know, it's amazing. It's on the order of 80%, and there are probably some 25% of people, or about 50 million, who took at least five medicines in the last week.
Mm.
It's remarkable how prevalent, and of course, when you look at the aggregate number, it's a huge number of prescriptions, somewhere around 3 billion every year, and it's amazing. You look at some 120 or so approved every year, and the new uses, the new guidelines, and it's something that always, always changes.
Yeah. Well, that's a really striking number when you say that there are 50 million people who take at least five, and I'm sure that there are particularly people who are in the older age groups, you know, people who might be in their 60s or 70s or 80s, who might even be taking more than that. And I guess one of the things that I do wonder about when you have people who are taking multiple medications is what potential there is for some kind of side effect that is a result of those things interacting that you wouldn't that individually if the person was only taking one, or maybe they were only taking two, that would be no problem. But if someone takes five or six or seven, do we really know what happens when all of those medications all get circulating in that person's body at once?
You know, the interesting thing about that, our bodies are wonderful machines, and whoever put this together is just a genius, as we know. And when you look at the removal mechanisms, basically the liver and our two kidneys, you have to think, intuitively, the more things that I put into this system, the more one of them is going to bump into the other, the more we're going to overwhelm transport systems. There are actually some little transport proteins that help you carry around medicines, also carry around some cholesterol, keep it off your arteries, bring it back to your liver. And you're exactly right. Intuitively, the more medicines you have, that probability of a potential interaction increases. And, of course, the other part of that is that when all of these things, and you start looking at how people get bad drug levels with good doses, people who are taking the right dose that their doctor prescribed, well, when you start getting removed by the same body system, all of a sudden that system can get overwhelmed. So the first medicine may stay in your body longer than you think. And with most medicines, that higher the level, even though it's a good medicine, the more likely adverse effects. So you're exactly right with that. It's a fascinating thing, although a very serious problem when you're trying to look at how do you get the best results from medicine.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that also argues for, as we have discussed before and people may have heard, that if you're taking multiple medications, it is probably a good idea for you, wherever you get your prescriptions filled, get them all at the same place so that then someone will be able to look at the whole list and say, well, now, wait a minute, if you're taking drug X, probably you should not also be taking drug Y.
And I think a lot of people tend to shop around, and you know, there's no question. There was just from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, their May research activities, not surprisingly, a significant increase in drug copayments reduced the patient's use of needed medicines. Well, what does that mean? We're challenged by how much these things cost, and it's a really well-known fact, and probably why we have the very nascent prescription drug program in this country for Medicare. But the interesting part is people tend to shop around and shop pharmacies. Where can I get these two more expensive medicines a little less expensively? And I'll go to this other one for these other things. And then when you start looking at non-prescription medicine use or herbal medicine use, then sort of all bets are off because there's no final common pathway to look at all those things. Bring them into your pharmacist. Ask if they have a brown bag session. But all those pills that you take, prescription, non-prescription, herbal, put them in a bag and bring them in and say, will you look at all these things and are these okay to combine together? That's a great idea. Also, once a year or every half year, look at your medicine cabinet, please. I can't tell you how many things people have in their medicine cabinets that they even no longer know what they are for. The labels are off. Throw those away, please. And it's remarkable what we don't take in simple steps to help protect ourselves. Mm.
Just now, since you mentioned that, what about over-the-counter medicines? If they all should have an expiration date on there, if you find something that's past its date, should you just throw it away?
Oh, exactly, and you flush it down the toilet. The challenging thing with that is that, my gosh, should I save it a little bit? Is there some potency, potentially, if you were in the middle of a jungle and that was the only medicine? Maybe there'd be some reason to take that, but no, not in this country. And the answer is, gee, you shouldn't have half of an antibiotic prescription left over. We've been sending bacteria to college for years doing that, which is why we have some very smart and resistant bacteria. And it also, when you start leaving those things around, it also brings up that whole idea, well, you know, I don't have any children, it's okay, and you've got these non-childproof tops, and then the grandkids come to visit. And that's a potential prescription for disaster. There's a very valuable number now in this country, a national poison control number, which I'd love to give to our listeners. It's 800-222-1222. And please write that down. Keep it by a phone. And if there's ever that, oh, my God, I think we've got too much medicine, there's something that's happened, it's an accidental poisoning with a household chemical, now there's one number to call. And it actually came from the American Association of Poison Control Centers, instead of having an individual state number. One number, very good, 1222.
All right. That's easy to remember, but it would be a good thing. That's one of those things you want to have. Put it in your medicine cabinet, stick it on your refrigerator, put it
Perfect
by your phone, you know, whatever, wherever you keep information like that. We have a caller. We'll get right to them. And again, I just want to introduce the guest, James Rybacki. He is a pharmacist. He's member of the clinical faculty at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy and is the author of the book, The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs for 2004. That's the new edition, and it's a book that has been updated, comes out a new version every year. HarperCollins is the publisher. It's out now in paperback. It's not terribly expensive, so you can go out and take a look at it in the bookstore. And, of course, here on the program, you have questions, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Chicago on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello, thank you. The popularity about Celebrex has been well advertised, and I was wondering if anything new has come along that you would say is as good or exceeds it, because I came upon something in the health food store called Trivestin, which claims that through a testing, comparative testing, that they exceed the effectiveness of Celebrex. I was wondering if you've ever heard of Trivestin.
Yeah, tell me about the generic component of Trivestin. That sounds like a brand.
Well, all I know is that this formulation has different herbs in it, and all I can do is refer you to their www.trivestin.com.
Okay.
And they could probably fill you in. If you haven't heard of it, I say that their pronouncements and seemingly this person that's using it has found it to be better than Celebrex, not as an endorsement or disclaimer against Celebrex, but it's without the side effects, apparently, also an added feature.
Okay, let's take a couple steps. Several things in that. When you see a comparator with Celebrex, and for our listeners, Celebrex is celecoxib. It's actually a selective COX-2 inhibitor. And are you taking this for arthritis or some sort of pain?
They are taking it for pain and arthritic and maybe inflammation.
Okay. And the key thing, when you look at, and there's no question that some herbal products can have anti-inflammatory sorts of benefits, and if you look at probably the oldest one was white willow bark, and there was a guy named Bayer who we would say, oh, Bayer aspirin, looked at that and said, these are salicylates, basically. So when you look at a claim that's made for side-by-side with a product, I have to be a little skeptical unless I know what's in it, because the brand I don't recognize. It doesn't mean it's good or bad. It just means that I don't recognize it. Two places for you to look and for our listeners to look, www.nccam.nih.gov. That's the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. And what you'll find there are some nicely balanced studies. The only comparator that I know that's an herbal product that was done in a rigorous study, and if you look at www.clinicaltrials.gov and put in that brand name Celebrex, was actually a pretty good comparator. But I think we need to know a little bit more data about what's in it. And the other question is, what were you taking for arthritis before?
They were actually trying to weather the storm naturally, you know, taking calcium supplements and other things that and keeping away from things that would be deleterious, you know, in terms of health, food assimilation. But they, with wear and tear, it also gets around to saying there are some claims about some calcium products being better absorbed than others. They are on in their years and have a general arthritic conditions. And at one time, they were even taking a product I think I talked to you once before called Rumalon.
Right, right. I do remember that. I do remember that call.
They're all in all trying to find out if you had heard about this Trivestin.
No, but I will go visit that website and we'll gleefully look at the ingredients.
Okay,
the comparator data, though, with Celebrex is glucosamine chondroitin, and that was found to favorably compare in arthritis. Now, this is kind of arthritis.
This is a glucosamine free product.
This is a chondroitin and a comparator that was actually not rheumatoid arthritis. We need to make that clear. This is osteoarthritis, or the weight-bearing sort of arthritis that we all sort of get as time goes on, because you sort of wear down your cartilage. Interesting point. But it looks like you're looking for a solution. Let's make sure it has real data.
Thank you very much.
All right,
you
bet. Thanks. And I have been looking at, even as we speak, at the website for Divestin, and it does describe the product, but at least what I'm seeing on the website, it does not say what is in it.
Ah.
So I guess someone would, if they were really that interested, would have to go and look at the package
exactly. And
see what that has to say. But it doesn't. It does not say.
One thing I would like to see on behalf of the FDA, certainly when there are these sorts of claims that there's a divulgence of here's the ingredient list. I think that certainly it's on the label. But where there are websites where people can go and then purchase these things, I think they ought to know what's in it. So they can then go look at an objective, unbiased source with good science behind it and say, oh, it's got this in it, and there is some data for that, or, oh, it doesn't. And unfortunately, a lot of herbal products are not only not well studied, but they're not well standardized. So sometimes product to product and situation to situation, not to say anything about Trivestin, I don't know it, but there may not be the active ingredient purported to be on the label in the pills. So you have to be really careful if you want a real health benefit from something from the health food store. And you, just like any prescription drug, you've got to track those results over time. And people, amazingly, are just very willing to put depression in the hands of unproven products, heart disease. And you really need to look at and set some goals and time frames and some measurements to say, oh, this thing is working, or, oh, it's not. And just like a prescription medicine, make a valid, rational decision.
Right. Let's talk with someone else in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm a pharmacist in Champaign.
Hi,
how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I recently read some information. Earlier you were talking about expired medications and flushing them down the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
I recently read some information recommending actually that people not do that because the water treatment systems aren't prepared to handle medications.
Ah, interesting point.
Back. Yeah, they're finding that coming back in the city water supply. So I was calling to see if maybe we could get the word out to listeners that that's not the best way to dispose of medications. Currently they're recommending either returning them to the pharmacy where we can send them in to a place for them to be destroyed or to just throw them in the trash, which of course,
When it goes to the landfill, what happens to the groundwater from the landfill?
Right, that's
yeah.
kind of questionable too with the trash. But if you return them to the pharmacy, and not all pharmacies will take it back per government regulations.
Right.
But we can take them back to be destroyed for the purpose of being destroyed and send them to a facility that has an incinerator.
That's a great comment. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay, before you go, do I understand? Is it true that there's some law that says if you do take them back to the pharmacy is supposed to take it back?
Well, I'm not certain on that law. I know the pharmacy is not allowed to take things back for the purpose of redispensing, obviously.
Yes, I am, right.
Yeah.
Okay. We do at our pharmacy take things back for the purpose of sending them to a return facility that incinerates the medication.
Hmm.
I don't know that pharmacies are required to do that. I'm sorry, I'm not up on the law on that.
Okay. Well, I was just curious because you made it sound like maybe that was the case.
No,
I'm not certain on the law.
Okay.
In many years in practice in Maryland, I would say the answer there is no, because you don't see bunches of people bringing bunches of pills in to be incinerated. Oh, that would be a very interesting service.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for the tip. I appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you.
And I certainly have heard these stories about what happens when you look at municipal wastewater.
Yes.
And that you find all these medicines in there. And I guess my understanding was that what's happening was that people were excreting them. people were taking them. They were going through their bodies. Some of them were perhaps not being absorbed, and that's why. And it wasn't because people had a half a jar of Prozac that they hadn't taken, and they flushed it down the toilet. It's because they were taking Prozac, and it or its metabolites were flushing through their system, and going where that all goes. And that was why stuff like that's in the water.
See, that's another interesting point. When you see chemotherapy patients, that of course is a big issue in hospitals, where you have to make sure that urine and actually body secretions that may contain a chemotherapeutic agent are in the toilet, which is exactly where they do go. That's how they're disposed of. And it's an interesting environmental point and some ramifications that I haven't thought of. That's fascinating.
Well, let's continue. We have someone next here in line on the cell phone. That'll be line four. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm on the road, so if I lose you, well, you'll know.
It'll be digital drop.
correct. I'm 36 years a diabetic, and I'm 56 years old. And until a year ago March, I never had insurance. I was never insurable, always self-employed.
Wow.
And when I got this, quote, job a year ago, I was thrilled to hear I could get insurance because I've been paying for all my own needles and insulin and everything. And no one ever prescribed anything to me in all those years I was trying to get health care outside the system. And now I'm on 5 drugs, and I get them every month to the tune of about $200-$300 a month. And I the same pharmacist as you suggested.
Good.
Because I was terrified of all of them interacting since I've done so well with my diabetes without insurance. My question is, when insurance comes in, then doctors see the need for my thyroid medicine and my ACE inhibitor and my blood pressure and my breast cancer possibilities, all these things I'm taking for? What does that have to do with the things? Did it not happen before?
The interesting thing is that when you look at it and you look at a typical diabetic, I happen to have one who's called a mother, and when you look at those things and a lot of diabetic management over time, unequivocally, the new set of guidelines that came out most recently for heart disease in women, evidence-based guidelines for cardiovascular disease, the prior secondary prevention guidelines from the American Heart Association, the American College of Cardiology, all recognized and somewhat newly recognized diabetes as a major potential risk factor for heart disease.
Yes.
And so when you look at that, with you brought up the ACE inhibitor, that actually controls the high blood pressure, also has some role in secondary prevention of heart attacks, and the insulin, a beta blocker and or aspirin. I'm surprised nobody worked up your thyroid before, which is...
Apparently it never happened. I happened to mention my hot flashes. I'm postmenopausal, and she felt like Effexor and Bellapause.
Uh-huh.
Bellapause taken at night and Effexor in the morning would get rid of the hot flashes, but meanwhile we better check your thyroid. So I no sooner got on the Effexor and the Bellapause than I was then issued Levoxil. And
that's actually, for our listeners, that's a thyroid replacement. The approach, though, is sound in that when you look at the way that these sorts of menopausal, even perimenopausal hot flashes used to be represented, well, it was an estrogen and a progestin combined, and because of the Women's Health Initiative, those have sort of become a last resort measure. And looking at the Effexors and other sorts of add-on therapies to try to control the flashes, which can be very, very compromising, that makes great sense. The other part, though, about the thyroid issue is that that can come up later on in life, and so earlier, a check may have been appropriate as part of a metabolic workup, but your thyroid problem, were you hypo or hyper? Low or high?
Hypo.
So low, okay. That can happen later on and in some sense fit the sort of, you're getting older and this is something we ought to check. You never had a medicine for high blood pressure before?
No, and my father had high blood pressure problems and also diabetes, but my blood pressure continues to be normal.
Okay, and that's outstanding. The other thing that's interesting, and not to bring up the case of my mother again on the air, but it's remarkable in that while most diabetics have some changes in blood vessels, she has not had any, and it's remarkable in the sense of her control or lack thereof, and some people, even though they certainly have the diagnosis, and don't handle blood sugar well, may not have the hypertension that comes along with it, although it's very surprising, and may not have, although again it's also very surprising, the blood vessel or vascular changes. So it's interesting, and you may not have had that, and certainly if your blood pressure was normal, you wouldn't want to start a prophylactic blood pressure medicine because you wouldn't be treating that, it wouldn't be appropriate. So interesting though in the sense that you have the insurance now, and now you have the medicines. And, of course, the other question is, did you have a glucose meter, and were you checking your blood sugar? Please tell me yes.
Yes, 4 times a day.
Oh, good.
4 times a day, and I was on 6 shots a day, but I didn't get my pump until I got insurance, because that was almost $10,000.
That doesn't surprise me, and for our listeners, the genesis of these pumps basically work like an organ in our bodies called the pancreas to give just the right amount of insulin in response to blood sugar levels and keep your blood sugar very normal. The goal in this is to keep it in a normal range, because when it starts getting too high or too low, there are serious metabolic and central nervous system. You tend to pass out if it's too high or too low. And you also have some tremendous damage that can happen over time, both to vision, to kidneys, to hearts, and keeping it right in that range is tremendous. So you're giving yourself 6 shots a day?
4 to 6 shots a day, that's correct.
Wow.
And I only weigh 120 pounds, so I've never suffered from obesity, because I viewed food for all my life as something I had to do. If I ate it, I had to shoot. You know what I mean?
Sure. I understand that there's an immediate consequence of having extra food, because you have to have insulin to balance the sugar that's going to come from the food being broken down, and you have to make sure it stays in the right level. That's an interesting approach. You sound very, very good about your medicines, though.
Well, I wouldn't be alive today if I didn't pay attention, and I was only concerned because of the... I guess I was a little leery about what insurance was going to do, since I'd been in charge all my life. I willed my body to the IU Med Center endocrinology department because since they neutered me very young in my teens, my mother had me, decisions were made that I shouldn't bear children because I wouldn't live long in the middle 60s. And they just kind of were ready to set up the dining room for some sort of hospital room, and I just took an attitude that was not where I was going. And as a result, I seemed to face it pretty well all my life. But now that I've had no children and I've never had surgery, the IU Med Center is very interested in getting my body, of course, on the slab. I'm not ready to go, but there's a doctor in there who told me that they would treat me. Give me standard tests at certain stages of my life, which have included my colonoscopy and my osteo thing where I get the bone scan.
Osteoporosis, that's important because
Absolutely.
When you said you're getting a little bit older, that's something, it's one of those hidden health threats.
Right.
I'm actually on an advisory board here in Maryland. Our listeners can actually look at that at www.strongerbones.org. And, of course, the large national website is the National Osteoporosis Foundation.
Good.
That's one of those things that gets missed, though, is, gee, how healthy are your bones? And you said you're 126 pounds.
No, 120.
Okay, I didn't mean to add the 6 pounds. But it's very good that your weight is, it sounds like, well in control. How tall are you?
5'3".
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. But when you think about thin females, you have to think about, as time goes on, that bone bank and if you're drawing on the bone bank or not.
Yes, and I have arthritis. It moves around in my body, and it's fairly untreatable. They did Celebrex for a while with no good results, and Vioxx, and finally he just told me to go back to any anti-inflammatory over-the-counter drug. So I take one Aleve a day, and I did ask the pharmacist if that would compromise any of the other medications I take. Now, if I can take up 1 second of your time, since you mentioned the breast cancer thing, I have been involved, this is my second year, on something called the STAR program.
Oh, the STAR trial is the study of tamoxifen and raloxifene.
That's correct.
And it's interesting.
Go ahead. I'm taking one a day of each, and I go back on July the 10th to determine whether I should continue or not, based on the fact that they wanted me in the program for 5 years before I turned 60,
yes,
because they don't give it to anybody after that. And I have 3 members in the family with breast cancer, 2 members with prostate cancer, and 2 members with cervical cancer,
wow,
and all of them are survivors.
Remarkable. So it wasn't sort of a highly invasive thing, but it was a malignancy. For our listeners, the STAR trial is the study of tamoxifen and raloxifen. These are medicines that are in the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, but they belong to a general class called SERMs, which are selective estrogen receptor modulators. And regardless of the name, there was some interesting studies. The tamoxifen is actually, quote, an old cancer drug. And raloxifene is a medicine that was approved for osteoporosis. The STAR trial is fascinating in the sense that it not only is going to look at a large number of women, 19,000, and it's actually fully enrolled now, it's going to look at them for 5 years, a long period of time, and I think the data from that is going to be very interesting and remarkable, what my nerdy research friends would say robust, And certainly when you look at that many people for that long an amount of time, I'm not aware of something being done like that over time with that magnitude. It's fascinating. And I've never spoken to someone who's been in the trial.
Well, here I am, and I guess I'm just being asked by my husband now, do you really need to stay in that trial since you're taking so many other drugs and you've done everything right so far? Are you compromising your health at this point by trying to be a part of that study? But for the larger good, I think it's fascinating, and I think I should be there. Do you see any problem with the things I'm already on?
In the sense of what you're taking, and those are pretty standard medicines, both for diabetes and thyroid replacement.
Good.
And when you look at the trial itself, and certainly there's a very specific you can reach the National Cancer Institute, just again for our listeners, 800-422-6237. But the specific trial is very, very interesting, and again, the sense of the number of people. The last look I had, I think, was about 13,000 patients were in it. But given what you said about the history that you have of breast cancer in your family, were those first-degree relatives, sisters, aunt? What were they?
My mother had a radical mastectomy at age 36, and subsequently they found cervical cancer and gave her a full hysterectomy.
Mm-hmm.
Then my little sister, who's 9 years younger than I, had exactly the same thing happen to her at age 36.
Wow.
And then I have a sister who was 38 years old when they uncovered breast cancer, and she didn't have to have anything removed, although the second sister did have one breast removed. And then the prostate are both my brothers, one a year younger, one a year older. And the other cervical cancer is from a fourth sister. There are seven of us children, actually.
Genetically, that's remarkable, both in the sense of the family. Part of my undergraduate work, I did at Creighton University in Omaha. And Creighton has a center actually looking at families and what happens with cancer and families. And I can understand both in the endocrinology sense and the complexity of your history, not to mention what's going on with the cancer itself. It's an amazing gift you're giving.
Thank you.
No, it is. It is, because that takes some time, and obviously there's some benefit in medicines. But the whole idea of trying to prevent an occurrence of a disease or condition in someone with a significant history like that. And again, given the fact that this is actually, you know, a National Cancer Institute study, so you've got valid science, valid researchers, and two very interesting medicines, that's just remarkable to me.
Well, I appreciate that. I did it, I have to say, for one selfish reason. With no insurance, I had to find a way that somebody would at least look at me if I showed up at the emergency room one day.
Oh, my God.
I had this horror going on that if I ever did go into, say, a diabetic coma, I travel for a living and have, only two or three times in my whole history had to have had an ambulance come to a hotel where my sugar went so low that they had to IV saline to me. But if someone, if I didn't know and I showed up at the hospital and said, yikes, I think I'm sick and it might not have something to do with diabetes, insurance companies have always found everything that might be wrong with me as a complication of diabetes. So I put myself in studies.
There are many, and for our listeners, there are many complications of diabetes, and I think Tommy Thompson and Health and Human Services have done a superb job working with the American Diabetes Association, sort of changing the definitions around a little bit, and we have a new term now called pre-diabetes, where it's sort of the beginning of a continuum that can go into frank diabetes. Now, since you're insulin dependent, by definition, that's a type 1 diabetes, and for all of our listeners, when you start to get overweight, you have some risk factors for diabetes, and some family history, you have some risk factors, and the earlier you start recognizing this, the better, because with some weight loss, and on my website at medicineinfo.com, there's a couple studies that are outlined there, a diabetes prevention study where a relatively simple thing called exercise can help prevent a significant number. And we're not talking lifting the car up and down. We're talking, you know, five times a week or so, half an hour. And it's amazing what you can do to prevent this.
I do it in hotels. Every time I check in, I check the exercise room. I get up on the cardio glide a half an hour, never kills anybody. But I'm particularly impressed by the fact that that I'm writing. I'm writing down these websites as I go. I'm always fascinated by all of that. If I don't die young, I will only be able to point to the fact that the IU Med people did point me in the right direction for studies and give me some exams when I thought maybe they were timely, and that I in fact treated food not like something that somebody owed me and I needed it to get over something.
Wow.
But rather that get up off that thing and walk a little bit, you know?
Yes, amen to that. You know, channel surfing is not an aerobic exercise. You know, let me be the first in the country to say that. And, you know, when you look at it, I struggle with that myself. I spend too many hours in my office, and it's difficult to get the exercise that I should be getting, and we all do. It's remarkable. Probably 50% in my book, that's about half of us in this country or more, are overweight. And a significant number are obese, and it's going into our children, and it's something that we need to take control of. That whole idea that you need to have a first plate of food and second plates of food, and you just have to just gorge yourself at every meal is ridiculous, and we need to get that idea into family practice, into primary care, and to actually say, well, you know what, let's look at your weight early, and, gee, let's have someone who is diabetic who's 120 pounds and stays about that. That's a wonderful thing.
Well, I'm jumping in here. I really appreciate the comments of the caller. We got a couple of other people I want to get to.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
And, you shouldn't apologize. One of the things that we like to do on this program is actually give callers and guests a chance to chat, you know, since we don't have the commercials and we don't have to tell people, okay, you got 30 seconds.
Oh, I've been there.
And so we don't do that. Our guest this morning, Dr. James Rybacki, he's member of the clinical faculty at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy and has been interviewed widely on many radio and television shows talking about health topics. And he is also the guy who's put together now for a number of years a book titled The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. And there's a new one every year. So the one now is Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2004. It's in paperback. It's published by HarperCollins and has a lot of information about prescription medicine. So you might take a look at it. And we also have questions here, opportunity to ask questions. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And next is a caller in Charleston, line two. Hello.
Thank you very much. I found an interesting article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal in March 28th of the year 2000. The article is entitled "Many Medicines Are Potent Years After Expiration Dates," and describes a study called the Shelf Life Extension Program that was limited certainly to they said 100 drugs, prescription and over the counter, and this, I thought, surprising finding was that there were many of them that were effective quite long after the officially noted prescription, expiration date.
Yes.
And although they are very clear in saying that the FDA says there's not enough evidence from this to say, well, ignore the expiration dates, but I guess I get around to a question that affects, a lot of us in either case. But with respect to over-the-counter drugs,
mm-hmm.
Will you make the same recommendation for, you know, you're past the expiration date, obviously not by a day or something, but
sure,
throw them away, or would you consider an extension or a modification of that with respect to things like aspirin, acetaminophen, ibuprofen, these sort of things? And I mention it both because of just some personal interest, obviously, mm-hmm. and with respect to these specific very common medications, a comment with respect to others as well. When you consider the healthcare has been mentioned, the cost of drugs has been mentioned or alluded to,
mm-hmm.
not only within this country, but in countries to which these drugs are exported or manufactured, and at least to some extent, the same requirements apply in terms of expiration dates.
Right.
And this is just horrendously expensive to assume that it's past the expiration date, throw it away.
Do you have any modifications to suggest? Sure.
The
science in this is actually very dependent on the clinical situation and the medicine itself. For example, if you look at those expiration dates, in general, they're calculated for a 90% potency. So when you look at that, see, what does that say? Well, you've lost 10% possibly, depending on how it was stored. And I think part of what the FDA is charged with is saying, well, you know what, let's make sure that these medicines are safe, effective, and when you look at that dating, what you're trying to play with, and I do understand the economics as well, is, well, okay, if it's digoxin, medicine for your heart that has to be kept in a very narrow level, sure, and for some reason you have an outdated medicine and your heart's dependent, that 10% or 15% or X percent, depending on how it was stored, can be life-threatening, and that's not a situation you want to play with. Mm-hmm. Aspirin is an interesting example because as aspirin starts to decay, part of what you'll smell, if you ever open an aspirin bottle and you smell vinegar, throw it away, because what you've got is actually the structure, the chemical itself breaking down. And I think the only way to handle that, certainly on the radio, is to say, you know what, talk to your doctor about that with the medicines that you're taking and ask that very pointed question. You're going back to the article in 2000 is actually interesting and makes sense, but certainly, you know, carte blanche, we couldn't advocate saying, well, you could go a week over this or 2 weeks because it depends so much on the situation, but it's a brilliant question.
Well, I was taking that into account. So certainly, medications that are more directly and seriously related to someone's state of health and mm-hmm. immediate sense and not getting over a hangover or a headache or whatever would be a more consequence.
Sure. I understand.
One more brief comment here, and
yes,
this is from the article. It said, they state, or the author states here, when pharmacists dispense a drug in any container other than what it came to them in, they routinely cut the expiration date to just 1 year after dispensing.
Right, and that actually relates to pharmacy law in the sense of you're basically repackaging from a stock bottle, and that again is a pharmacy issue, trying to make sure that the medicines are safe and effective, and it's repackaging into a smaller container size. Yep, you're exactly right.
At the time of the article, it says, in fact, in 17 states, pharmacists are now required to do that. Do you know, is Illinois one of those, or what our law is with respect?
That's interesting. No, I don't. But that's the benefit of doing these sorts of programs and having callers like yourself. I'll find out in Maryland, and I'll actually shoot David back an email. Maybe we can find a way to get that to you. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly a standard of practice in the sense of what, you know, I've typically done. Oh, yep, here's the date, here's the out date, and yep, it's a year from when I'm personally dispensing that. Mm-hmm. So certainly in Maryland, that is something that we do.
Mm-hmm. Also, I'm sorry, but
yes,
you're familiar with that. I want to be sure and mention that not only was the article published 4 years ago, but the study was done even substantially before that. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you are aware of any, is there a continuation of that shelf life extension program or those kinds of studies?
No, and it might be interesting if you look at the pharma website and put in expiration date and search it that way, or American College of Clinical Pharmacy or the American Society of Health System Pharmacists might have some data on that. But your points are very, very interesting in the sense of what's a realistic balance. And I think the safest thing, given the labeling itself, is to throw it out when it expires by the expiration date. Mm-hmm. And your question is a little more involved in that in the sense of, well, but could you if you had to, or would you want to? And I think those are best answered by your doctor.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Right.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Let's go to Kankakee for the next caller, line 3. Hello.
Good morning, David Inch.
Yes.
Yes, Dr. Frybacki.
Good morning.
The essential monosaccharides are simple sugars of which it has been suggested that they are absolutely necessary in human nutrition, all of which are said to be readily available in the diet, and of which it has been suggested that they are difficult to synthesize in people of less than perfect health, thus resulting in essential monosaccharide deficiencies. Do you have a view on essential monosaccharide supplementation?
Interesting. Tell me which specific ones you're interested in. 'Cause, no, in the sense of replacing some things metabolically that you can't make or make in fewer quantities, are you thinking about sort of depletion of what's in the foodstuffs that we're eating or
well,
what we can't make?
There's 8 of them. 2 of them are readily available in the diet.
Okay.
They're discussed in Harper's Biochemistry. Some of them are available in tree gums and the medicinal mushrooms of Japan and so forth. They are said to promote intercellular communication, without which there's lots of difficulties. I've come in contact with a point of view that suggests that supplementation works wonders, a panacea almost. I just wondered if you had any view on this.
No, it's interesting. This is the first time I've bumped into this question and that issue. It'll be interesting to take a look and do a little homework on this. But interesting in the sense of if it was prevalent, I would think I would have seen it at some of the national conventions, and I've not, which may mean just simply the sense that it's not been studied well in, quote, mainstream science. But again, for our listeners and for you as well, I'd take a look at www.nccam.nih.gov, that National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, and put in essential monosaccharides in that search box and take a look and see what you come up with, because I'm going to do the same thing.
I will do that. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
You're welcome.
We have time for maybe one, possibly two people, if you want to give us
Let's do an hour more.
Well, we'll just have to do it on another day.
There we go.
I can't go past my regular time. Just let me get back real quick to something, because it has to do with making sure that the shelf life of your medicines, that you're going to get what you're supposed to be able to get, and that is storage. What is considered to be proper conditions for storing medicine?
Oh, please not in the medicine chest, in a bathroom where you routinely take a shower and it gets, you know, when you think about a locked cabinet in your kitchen, that would be a fine place. Somewhere where it's secure, has a sustained and not variable humidity level. It's amazing to me that we have these things in the bathroom and we have basically containers that are reasonably well sealed, but they're also somewhat permeable, and if you put them in a humid environment, don't do that. They're not going to keep as well for you.
All right, so basically at normal room temperature, but the important thing is that you don't want it to be into a place that's very damp.
Exactly. Well, and of course, the other situation is you need to make sure you look at the label, and that's something I've covered in the Essential Guide, storage. If there's particular storage to avoid or refrigeration that's required, you'll really shorten some shelf lives if it's supposed to be refrigerated and you don't. Great thought.
All right. Something else that I actually thought about asking you the last time we talked, and I didn't get around to it, and I'm not sure if it's too complicated, but it was at a time when there was a great deal of discussion about the high cost of prescription medicine and about the fact that some people were buying their drugs from Canada because they were cheaper. And the reaction of the sort of official government agencies like the FDA to that was, well, it's not a good idea. We don't allow importation of drugs from Canada because we're concerned about safety. And that was one of the things that I wanted to ask, whether indeed that, as far as you're concerned, is that an issue? I mean, some would, should, if they get their medicine from a pharmacy in Canada, should they really have reason to doubt whether that is, whether it is in fact what it says it is?
A couple things come into reality now that we're post 9/11 as well. There's a potential for adulteration. If you're getting it from a website that says, you know what, I'm a Canadian website and you can get this for X number of dollars cheaper, that's sort of the frightening thing, because you're not sure if you order things from an internet that doesn't have a VIPS seal, a verified internet pharmacy practice site seal on it. You're not sure really where the medicines are coming from. And there have been some cases. Our listeners can take a look at www.fda.gov. There's a huge section on importation of medicines and some of the caveats there. The other sorts of issues are, if you're looking at this to see if it's less expensive, there are some hidden costs that involve both shipping and some exam, quote-unquote exam, which is basically a questionnaire filled out. There's a site that's a commercial site that I found to be valid, although there is a fee. It's pharmacychecker.com, and that's about $24 a year. But it'll tell you the medicines that you might be considering if they're really less expensive, and when you look at the other add-on costs, if they truly are. The first thing, of course, is to ask about a generic medicine for your doctor. That, unequivocally, can cut your cost by half with medicines in this country. The other issues, which sort of with the prescription drug program may have become less of an impact, are, is there potential for adulteration? If you're going to get them from a pharmacy that's actually in Canada, well, obviously you're right there, and the Canadian population is not dying from their medicines. I've heard that sort of argument before. But it's gotten embroiled in all of the possible adulterations, some of the real counterfeiting that's gone on. It's something you really need to be careful of and check out very carefully.
Well, we will have to stop there. We want to say thank you very much, Dr. Radbacki, for being
Absolutely.
With us. And I'm sure if you would like to be on the program again sometime in the not-too-distant future, we'd be happy to have you.
I would love that. I have a new book coming out. I've been working with a group called Mended Hearts, and I'd love to discuss that.
All right. Well, we'll be in touch. Thank you very much.
Stay well. My pleasure.
Dr. James Radbacki, he's a member of the clinical faculty at University of Maryland School of Pharmacy, and the book that we have mentioned, if you're interested, is The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs 2004. It's published by HarperCollins. Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. The broadcast is also made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from Europe, the Middle East, India, and around the world. Food tastings held every Saturday from 11 to 5. World Harvest Foods at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. The end of our fiscal year is now just 9 days away, and we are still about $100,000 short of our goal for listener support. Federal State University of Illinois funding for next fiscal year is still uncertain. The only way that we will be able to provide the program service that you expect is with your help right now. Please give us a call, 217-244-9455, and make a credit card contribution. If you've never supported the station, this would be a great time to start. Maybe if you're a current member, you could increase your level of contribution. Either way, that would be great. You could also send us a check. Make it out to UIF, WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin is the address. That's in Urbana, 61801. Or again, call 217-244-9455. And we thank you very much. That's where we'll finish up here. We want you to stay tuned, though. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we dip into the archives and we rebroadcast an interview from November of last year when we talked with Dolores Hayden, a professor of architecture, urbanism, and American studies at Yale. She's the author of Building Suburbia. That's coming up today following the 1 o'clock news. Taking a look now at prices on the Board of Trade. July wheat, $3.45, down 9 1/4. September, $3.53 1/2, down 9 3/4. July corn, $2.67, down 7 1/2. September corn, $2.72 1/4, down 6 3/4. December, $2.76 3/4, down 5 1/2. And March, $2.83, down 4 1/2. July soybeans, $8.88 1/2, unchanged. August, $8.18, up 1/2. November beans, $6.70 1/2, down 8 1/2. July soybean meal, $2.94.50, up 1.50. July